So we've all had the chance to go and practice together for a while, do some meditation. A chance to be silent. A chance to escape from everything. And very soon we'll be heading back. The world outside won't have changed very much. Perhaps the world inside might have changed a little bit. Hopefully when we go back, we'll go back with a little bit more. A little bit more contentment, a little bit more wisdom, a little bit more peace. And that's not a bad thing to bring into the world. And each of us will face those challenges about what do we do? Take what we've learnt on this retreat and make it meaningful to those people around us, to the people we work with. And this is a question that will be answered very differently by everyone in the room. I think there is a sense in which once we experience the Dhamma and we experience the joy and the power of meditation, that we want to share that. We don't want to just keep it for ourselves. And of course, that's part of what the metta practice is. Sometimes it's difficult to know how to do that. We certainly don't want to go and tell everybody how enlightened we are and how they really need to go and do these retreats, because if they don't hurry up and get enlightened, they're going to be really annoying. Tell other people how much they need to do some metta meditation. Of course, the best way of sharing the Dhamma is to just be kind, be quiet, be caring, be an example, have some wisdom. You know, it's shocking sometimes how little wisdom there is in the world. How many times people make decisions on such kind of silly and selfish and narrow-minded grounds. And if we practice meditation, we can get the space in our minds to step back from this and ask ourselves, what's going on here? Why am I like this? Why am I trying to make this happen like that? Why am I trying to do this to that person? And so I can't always guarantee that you'll make the right decision. But it does help. It helps you to be more reflective about what your choices are, and also helps you to be more accepting and responsible when you have to see what the results of those things are. So one of the things that we kind of learn in meditation as an inescapable reality in meditation is how much we are responsible. How much we're responsible for our own minds. And it's really astonishing. You know, you've had that experience the last couple of days. You can sit here and all you're doing is sitting quietly in a quiet room with nice people who are also sitting quietly in a quiet room. And how busy is it? Seems like it's just as busy as everything else outside, isn't it? Seems like you just never stop. And you keep on blaming everybody else. Why aren't I peaceful? Keep on criticizing people, running through arguments in your head. It's always good when you have arguments in your head. You always win them. Well, of course, you lose because of the fact that you're having an argument in your head. That's, you've lost that way, right? But you win the argument, usually. So what are we doing talking to all these voices in our head? It's kind of weird, isn't it? Sitting there having these conversations. A room full of silent people chattering away. One part of our mental development and cognitive development is to be able to change the nature of the conversations we have. The conversations we have with ourselves. So the Buddha talked about this in one of the discourses, the Dvaita-Vitakka Sutta. And talked about the two kinds of thought and said that his thoughts associated with harming and greed and so on, and if he has those ones then he suffers. If he has the thoughts associated with letting go, with loving kindness, with compassion, then he can keep on thinking those thoughts all day and night and no harm will come of that. This is something that's very important and to understand. Thoughts themselves, there's nothing wrong with thoughts. There's nothing wrong with... That's just how the mind works. Don't become an enemy of your mind. Don't imagine that there's something wrong with the way that the mind works. There isn't. That's just how it is. Right? It's just nature. It's not right or wrong. It's like saying there's something wrong with how the trees grow. There's something wrong with how the rain falls from the sky. Something wrong with the way the planets circle around the sun. It's just how nature is. It's neither right nor wrong. So the way your mind goes, it thinks and so on, that's all right. But we just understand that if we think certain kinds of thoughts, it tends to be harmful. Create suffering for ourselves and create suffering for others. Right? Create suffering directly for ourselves when we have those thoughts and create suffering indirectly when we manifest those thoughts through our speech and our behavior. So the good thoughts, we can keep thinking those. Loving thoughts, kind thoughts. One of the interesting things about the conversations you have in your head, I don't know if you've ever noticed this, but the conversations you have in your head have a grammar to them. And the grammar is actually quite telling. So some of our conversations we have in our heads are in the third person. He said, she said. He did this, she did this. Right? You think about that. What's that kind of conversation like? Right? I'm talking with somebody. Somebody else is out of the room, and I'm talking about them while they're not even present. He said, she said. Other kinds of conversations we have in our heads are second person, right? So the second person conversation is already much friendlier, isn't it? Because you're actually talking to someone. Right? So you can try this if next time you're having an argument with somebody in your head. You know, you notice, is that person actually present in your head or not? Is it a third person argument? If it's a third person argument, change it to a second person argument. So that it's you. Right? You always have much greater chance of settling an argument if you actually talk to somebody, talk to the person you're having an argument with, rather than talking about them. But of course, even having a second person discussion in your head is a little bit weird, because the second person actually isn't there. Right? It's still just a figment of your imagination. So you're still just arguing with yourself. So if you want to be more real about it, then you change all those second person statements to first person statements. Because that's actually all that there is. The only conversation you're having in your head is a conversation with yourself. So instead of saying, he did, she did, you can say, you did. And instead of saying, you did, you could say, I did. Because that's who's actually talking. You know? I did this, I did that. And you realize that all of those things that you're whinging about and complaining about and so on are actually only ideas in your head. Even if they're things that happened in the world, they're already in the past. They're not happening now. Even if somebody did say something in the past, that's gone. That's in the past. That's not real. Right? That's already gone. It only exists now as an idea in your head. You're the one who's creating that idea. And you're the one that's making suffering for it. It's very important to recognize this. You know, we think that, you know, we're sitting there and, I can't shake these memories. These memories keep bothering me. Memories don't bother you. Memories don't have any power. Memories are in the past. You have a million memories stored away in your brain somewhere that don't come and bother you. They just sit there. Right? You're the one who's bothering the memories. You're the one who's going up, going back and digging those memories out and dragging them into the present moment to torture yourself with them. Yeah? It's the energy. You have to spend the energy right now to make those memories come alive. The memories are like, oh, come on, please, just leave me alone. I was having a nice rest there in the past. I don't know if I go through this again. I'd much rather just be left alone. But you insist on going back and dragging them out. Well, the same with the fears of the future. Is that worried? What's going to happen? You're afraid. So all of these things which we're externalizing, which we're blaming, is actually all just things that we're doing right now. Criticizing others in your head, that's just something that you're doing. Worrying about what might happen, that's something that you're doing. So rather than coming to meditation and thinking, oh, I have to get rid of thoughts, how can I stop thinking? Why do we think that? Why do we think I have to stop thinking? It's ridiculous. Why would you want to stop thinking? Right? It's because you're not comfortable with yourself. It's because you've got all these different parts of yourself who do all these stupid, mean, nasty things, and you don't want to know about them. You want them to go away. Go away and leave me alone. Right? If all of those thoughts in your mind were loving and kind and wonderful thoughts, would you be wanting to get rid of them? I don't think so. So sometimes what happens when we come to meditate, we sit down and we want to just make these thoughts go away. We want our mind to be quiet. Okay? And it's usually not very successful. we usually can't stop those thoughts. We can't make them go away. And if we do, then it's only for a very short time. We can make our mind still for a very short time by kind of forcing it, but then it's very tense, and sooner or later the thoughts come back even stronger than they were before. So that kind of approach to meditation, which is very, very common, but it's not based on understanding, it's not based on wisdom. If you come from a point of view of wisdom, then you ask, well, what are these thoughts? What's actually going on? Why am I sitting there having a conversation with myself? I mean, on the face of it, it's a weird way to live, right? Or to walk around having conversations with yourself. Surely you know already what it is that you're going to say, right? Why are you talking to yourself when you already know what's being said? Why do we keep on going over the same conversations again and again and again, right? Yeah, there's another thing that's really bizarre. We keep on saying the same things again and again and again. What's happening? Why are our minds like that? Yeah. So if we want to progress in our meditation, we have to learn to understand this a little bit. So what's going on is essentially that our minds are very good at compartmentalizing. In psychological terms, we say that our minds are not very integrated. So that means that we take different bits of our mind and we lock them up in different areas. And very often those areas correspond to or are represented by images of people in our minds. And so our relationship with such and such a person is one part of our mind, such and such a person is another part of our mind. What we do at work is in one part, what we do at home is in another part. And of course these different parts have something to do with each other, right? They're not completely independent. But they're relatively independent. There's some separation between them, and there's usually a tension between them. You might, for example, behave. I just give one example. When this from my upbringing, my mother was a school teacher, and somebody said once that one of her students or something told me that she was a really strict teacher, right? I had no idea that she was a strict teacher. She wasn't a strict mother. She was a very kind and loving and warm mother. So she obviously had a different kind of persona maybe in the classroom than she had at home. And that's something that we all have to manage, right? So we maybe have different personas in different places. And how do we manage that? How do we negotiate that? Well, it's never entirely clear. So these different parts of our mind need to communicate with each other. And this is one of the ways that they communicate, by talking with each other, by these different conversations we're having in our head. Right? So this is why I'm saying that this process of thinking and so on, it's not just random and it's not just a waste of time. It's actually important that our mind learn to communicate, different parts of our mind learns to communicate with each other. The problem is not the thinking as such. The problem is that the quality of the communication is often not very good, because our thinking is chaotic, it's full of different kinds of unhealthy emotions and so on that's fueling it. And most importantly, the process of thinking is not very healthy because we don't listen. Right? We think and think and think, and we don't listen. This is the most important thing. Why is it that we keep saying the same things over and over again? Again, just think about that. If you're in contact with somebody and they keep coming to you with the same complaint, right? Why is that? Well, usually it's because you're not listening. You're not hearing their complaint. You're dismissing it. You're trivializing it. You're minimizing it. You're not really taking it on board and seeing whether something needs to be done about it. And so this is why the mind keeps on going round and round and round in circles. It's talking and talking and talking, and it's not listening. So that capacity to listen to our own mind, Right? Sometimes we call it mindfulness or awareness, whatever we want to call it. Right? Is to actually, with compassion and care, to give the time to actually hear what it is I'm saying. If you have an angry voice in your mind, rather than just dismissing it and saying, you're angry, I don't like you, you make me feel icky, I don't want to be an angry person, so I'm going to get rid of you, right? I'm going to chop you off and throw you away because you're an icky, angry person and I don't like to have anything to do with you. Okay? And of course, by doing that, you're not at all looking what the cause of it. Why are you angry? Yeah? Now, one of the things which is also, it's a very simple lesson, but that we forget time and time again, is that most of the time, all we need to do is listen. Actually, right? Most of the time, right? If we listen fully with attention and with compassion, what is that thought saying? Oh, okay, where's that coming from? We listen, we really understand what's going on. And very often, that's enough. Now sometimes it's not, maybe sometimes we need to do something else, right? But very often, we need to listen. When we're complaining about that other person, rather than just trying to shove that complaint out of our minds, we listen to the complaint. We say, oh, you're really hurt when that happened. Yeah? And you listen for the pain that underlies it. Where is the suffering? Why? Where is the suffering that's causing these thoughts to happen? Right? And so as long as we're shutting the thoughts out, getting rid of them, there's no compassion there. There's not actually hearing what the suffering is that's creating the problem. So instead of shoving thoughts away, alienating them, repressing them, getting rid of them, we accept them. You listen to them compassionately. Okay? With understanding. Oh, okay. That's how you're feeling now. It's okay. And when you do that, well, you have to do it sincerely. When you do that sincerely, you listen to them, then the need that's driving in your mind, the need to communicate, to integrate, and the need for the different parts of your mind, right, to connect with each other, that need is satisfied, right? That the connection has been made through that mindful and wise and compassionate listening. You're making the connections between the different parts of your mind. And then that energy is dissipated, the tension is dissipated, and the thought doesn't need to come up so much again. Often it doesn't need to come up at all. Right? How is it possible? I want you to think about this carefully. How is it possible that you can achieve real stillness and peace in your mind, real oneness in your mind, right? If all of these different parts of your mind are still compartmentalized and not listening to each other and not understanding each other? How is that possible? It's not possible. Right? At the very most, you'll get an illusion of a sort of temporary peace, the illusion of samadhi or oneness. And this is actually not uncommon in psychology. They call it dissociation. And you can become so disconnected from what's going on in your own mind that you think that you've solved all these problems. You think you've found this place of peace and stillness, but it's not real peace and stillness because it's based on exclusion. You know, it's like you're in a country that's sort of surrounded by barbed wire and walls and guns and missiles, and you know, you're in the middle of all of that and you're saying, oh yes, it's nice and peaceful. So real peace comes from acceptance. Yeah? So when you're meditating, when these thoughts come up and so on, don't try to get rid of them. Just understand them. Have compassion for them. As when we're doing the metta meditation, loving kindness, then Of course, this kind of approach is even more important because it's very easy to develop a loving kindness, which is a loving kindness, which is based on a kind of idealism or on a kind of fantasy, right? I mean, it's a lot easier to do loving kindness for people when they're not actually there. It's a lot easier to do loving kindness when you're alone in a room, oh, so and so be happy, and so on. And then when you actually have to deal with them, it's a bit more of a challenge. Yeah, so doing it in the abstract is a bit easier. So when we do the meditation, right, when we bring to mind these different people during the meditation, right, again we do it with this mind of just accepting. As we go on, our mind and our body will throw up all kinds of strange things which will distract us and sometimes lead us astray. So in Buddhism we have a concept of a being called Mara. Mara is like the trickster or the tempter, and so he's always trying to go up to the monks and the nuns and distract them from their meditation. Sometimes he'll, you know, take a very fearful form and try to scare you, sometimes very seductive form, and all these different kinds of forms. Mara is a master of shape-shifting. Yeah? So he can come in whatever form that he wants. And always trying to take you away from meditation. And one of the very nice things about Mara, because Mara is kind of equivalent to, you know, Satan or the devil in the West, but whereas Satan or the devil is like this kind of evil who just wants to kill and maim and so on, Mara is always very kind and compassionate, right? And Mara always comes and says, "Oh, it's a cold, hard night here, staying in this hut in the forest. Surely you'd be more comfortable back at home. Oh, and there's that you know, that really good TV show is on tonight. You know, you." Oh, your family must be missing you so much. Yeah. You should really go back and see them. And the Mara's always very compassionate. He always got a kind word. Yeah. And so this Mara who comes up in the meditation takes many different forms. And I'm sure many of you have experienced those different kinds of Mara and so on. Yeah. I remember one time when I was in Sydney, there were some Thai monks who were visiting, and we invited for dana at this very wealthy supporter's home. We went to their kind of huge mansion in Vaucluse, and there's all these Mercedes in the driveway, and everything's like incredibly rich and money everywhere. And we're going through the house, and there was a shopping bag from the shop Max Mara. I showed it to this Thai monk and explained what it meant, and he just laughed. So, we've talked about the loving kindness, we talked about the loving kindness for oneself and for a loved person, and the two remaining people are the neutral person and the disliked person. Now, because this is only a very short retreat, we're only really just getting started, so I don't expect you to, you know, have even, you know, much results or whatever from doing even those first two stages, and so it's a bit premature to talk much about the other two stages, but I'll just mention them very briefly this morning so that you have an idea of what's involved, so that if you want to keep on going with the practice, you know where it should be going. So just as we did the loving kindness for oneself and for a loved person, we're keeping the metta like settled inside the body, and we're concentrating on the feeling of metta. So we're using the words in order to hold our attention and bring our attention to the feeling of metta. Yeah? And we developed metta for oneself and for a loved person in a way that so that the feeling of metta that we're experiencing would be just the same in those two stages. This is the ideal, this is what we're looking for. And so that we can hold that and keep that inside our body for a reasonable amount of time. Right? You should be able to do it and keep it all the way through your body for 20 minutes, 30 minutes, or even longer. Now, once you can do that, you want to start doing metta for a neutral person. Okay, so who's a neutral person? Okay, so basically there's about 7 billion or so neutral people on the planet. So just pick one. But, you know, like we did with the loved person, we should be a little bit, choose the neutral person with care. Neutral person should be somebody that you know. Okay, so it's not just a random individual. Somebody you know, you should at least know their name, somebody that you say hello to and so on. Often it's good to choose maybe someone at the local Dhamma group or meditation group, maybe someone in your neighborhood, someone you work with, something like that. So it's somebody who you're on kind of friendly terms with, but you don't have any strong feelings about one way or the other. You don't know them well enough to be able to have any particular likes and dislikes about them. So as we did with the loved person, with a neutral person, we should also just choose one person each meditation. Alright? So I don't need to go through the whole 7 billion neutral people every meditation. That's okay, just one is enough. If you want to, you can use different people in different meditations. Right? So that's fine. But in the one meditation, just one loved person, one neutral person. And it's a good idea because the neutral, when we're doing the meditation for the neutral person, those neutral feelings, right, are associated with disinterest. Okay, so somebody who we don't either like them or dislike them, we don't really care about them very much. So usually somebody like that, you don't think about them, right? You're not interested in them. And because of that, it's not uncommon that when you do this third person in the metta meditation, that your mind also becomes uninterested, right? You get bored. The feeling of metta, the joy that you have when you're doing metta for somebody you love, and you do metta for somebody that you don't care about, and that joyful feeling just kind of fades away. And you're like, oh yeah, whatever. Yeah, may you be happy or not, you know, whatever. And right. So this is a tendency. So if it won't necessarily happen. Maybe if your energy is good and your metta is strong, that won't happen. But if it does happen, just recognize that. And all it's doing is actually quite useful. It's telling you that you're not ready to do that stage yet. Okay. So this is one of the good things about metta meditation, is that it's got this kind of built-in sort of progress reports, if you like. You know, what do they say? KPIs, right? So you've got your KPIs there, right? If the feeling of metta disappears, then that's telling you that, okay, you just come back to the earlier stages and you develop those stronger and stronger and stronger and stronger. Right? So there's nothing wrong with just experimenting and playing around. So if you're interested to do the metta for that neutral person, then fine, go ahead and try it. But if you're finding the energy is not really sustaining, the feeling of metta is not really sustaining, then just come back to the early stages and do that. That's fine. And then the last one we do is the metta for the disliked person. Right? So, yeah, that's where the chickens come home to roost, isn't it? Yeah. Right. So who are we going to choose for our disliked person? Right. So for myself, when I do the disliked person, I usually choose... No, I won't say... So you have to find somebody who's It doesn't have to be like a mortal enemy or something like that, right? My arch nemesis. Who's my arch nemesis? Maybe it's somebody who's like, you know, you've been locked in a karmic battle of wills for countless lifetimes, right? You keep getting reborn as enemies and playing out the same battles. Feels like that sometimes, doesn't it? I did one retreat where we go to this fourth stage of doing loving kindness for the disliked person. And when I did talk to people in their interviews, and they became the pattern of who the disliked person was so consistent that instead of saying the fourth person was the disliked person, I just said the fourth person was the husband. True story. I said that only half jokingly. One of the ladies in the retreat said, "Oh, you know, I just want to let you know that I have a really loving relationship with my husband. We really understand each other well, and we support each other spiritually." And so I said, "Okay, that's fine. I'm glad that that's the case." Yes. A couple of years later, she was divorced. But anyway. Oh dear, bad, isn't it? Anyway, so who do we choose for the disliked person? Anyway, so it's just somebody who you find annoying, right? Somebody who, when you think about them, you know, just gets on your nerves. Right? Now, of course, the problem with the disliked person is like the opposite of the problem that we have with the neutral person. With the neutral person, we find it hard to keep thinking of them. So we have to make sure we sort of pump up the feeling of joy at that neutral stage, so you've got more interest and excitement about doing it. Right? But with a disliked person, the problem is you can't stop thinking about them, right? So as soon as you bring them to mind, it keeps on going round and round and round your head. And you'd be amazed, right? You'd be amazed. You can sit there and you can do metta meditation for months, and you think, wow, this is going really well. And then you have a really good, powerful meditation. You think, okay, now I'm ready to do metta for that disliked person. I feel so good, and my metta is so strong. And you do metta for the disliked person, and then in like 5 minutes you're in this mindless fury and rage, and and everything that you've done for all those months has just been completely shattered. Oh dear, start again. So because we're in the meditation, everything's more intense, right? I'm sure you've already noticed this, right? When you're meditating, everything's more vivid, everything's more real, everything's more intense, right? And so when you're thinking about that disliked person, all of those negative thoughts and energies come to you in a way that's also much more intense and much stronger, right? It's not, you can't forget it, you can't ignore it. So when we come to that disliked person, if you find that you start thinking about them, you find that all those negative things are coming back up and so on. Again, that's just a sign that you're not ready to do that stage yet. Okay? So just put it to one side, come back, keep on developing at the lower stages. The metta for yourself, metta for a loved one, metta for the neutral one. And when that's really strong and powerful and clear, and you want to try doing it for the disliked person, okay, try that again. And then see how you go. And usually you'll find that, whereas with the neutral person, the mind tended to become a bit dull. With the disliked person, the mind becomes extremely energized, right? It's very powerful. And mindfulness becomes really sharp. And your focus becomes incredibly clear. You know exactly what it is that you're doing. And you're sitting down there and you know there's an intuition, there's a feeling in your heart. You can't explain it, but you just know somehow that this is what you need to be doing. That this is something that's incredibly important and incredibly powerful. And so if you have the energy and if you have the mindfulness and if those feelings of anger and negativity don't come up, then just stay there as long as you can. Right? So once you're with that fourth person, you really should try to just keep on going as long as you can. Just don't go to work that day, or whatever. It doesn't matter. You just sit there and keep meditating, okay? And the further you go, then the deeper you'll find that this feeling of metta comes, and the more and more you'll go into that feeling of peace, that feeling of joy, right? Until eventually it just all disappears. All of that, all of those problems and issues that you've had, all of the everything, all the struggle just goes. It's like something just disappears from your mind, like all of the rubbish in your mind that you're so used to for all these years has just gone. It's like you've walked around your whole life in grey skies and fog, and for the first time ever, the fog has cleared and the clouds have separated and the sun is shining forth. And you're like, that's what they call the sun. that's the brightness of the mind, that's the brilliance of the mind. And when you experience it and you realize how deeply clouded and distorted and disturbed our mind is by these forces, these greed, hatred and delusion. How beautiful and radiant and powerful that our mind is. When it's not obscured by these things. And this is when you understand, oh, this is what the purpose of the meditation is. This is why I've been suffering all these years. Yeah? Our mind's been clouded by these things. I never even knew it. I never knew how strong they were. And I never knew how beautiful the mind is when it's freed from these kinds of obstructions. So this is the path of metta meditation in brief. I'm just sort of touching on some of those more, more developed or more advanced stages of the practice there, just so you have some idea of where you're heading. But don't be in a hurry. The success of your developing the meditation depends absolutely on the care and the patience with which you develop all the foundations of meditation. And if you feel that the meditation is not going anywhere, you feel that you're frustrated or you're not seeing any change or any progress, you don't create the progress in meditation by trying harder and trying to get to more places. You create the progress in meditation by stepping backwards and looking at the fundamentals and thinking, how can I do those fundamentals better? How can I be kinder? How can I keep my precepts better? How can I be more generous? How can I be more gentle? By developing those qualities, these will be the things that will be the foundation for your meditation. Unfortunately, I should stop there. We have to go and start doing the interviews. So I will leave you to practice for the rest of the morning, and I will see you a bit later on. I think after lunchtime I have a final closing meeting or something like that. So until then, have a wonderful morning's meditation.